It is between the great lie of a materialist concept of life and the great truth of a spiritual one. We call the first a lie because it asserts that we are here on earth solely to satisfy the appetites of the body and the desires of the ego. Throughout man's long history, his wisest seers and most illumined prophets have put forth their thoroughly tested discovery and not opinion that the forces of nature, God, brought us here to discipline those appetites and elevate those desires as a preliminary requisite to the higher purpose of life, ere the discovery of the overself and the conscious union with it. Millions have been deceived by the appearance of things into believing that their existence is physical and nothing more. Today they are eating the sour fruit of this false belief. Correct self-understanding would have shown them that they are not only creatures compounded of body, feelings, and thoughts, but also of spiritual intuitions. That is why the firmest possible foundation upon which to build any social structure is the essential ethics of all spiritual teaching. Those ethics ultimately sprout from a mystically revealed knowledge of certain moral and spiritual laws which govern the universe. The new understanding of these old laws, which go far deeper than politico-economic doctrine, would necessarily bring about a new and better integration of society, which would then reflect ethical thought. The impartial observer may seem pessimistic, but he knows that world conferences will fail so long as statesmen go to them only to protect their present interests, to make patchwork solutions, and to avoid uncomfortable concessions. They will fail so long as rulers and peoples prefer a shallow to a deeper view. They will prove, as was predicted several years ago in an earlier book, mere delusions so long as a loftier ethical ideal and superior metaphysical knowledge do not animate them. When a materialistic civilization becomes outwardly impressive but remains inwardly impoverished, when political relations become an elaborate facade for hiding the spiritually empty rooms behind them, menacing problems are sure to appear on every side. The real contemporary problem behind all the other ones is the problem of mental and moral regeneration. Those who know the hidden powers of thought in the life and fate of man, know that external peace cannot be successfully secured while internal war rages in the heart. Until men tame their angers, discipline their desires, leash their greeds, modify their materialism, and curb the cruelty and slaughter they practice on animals, the root causes of war will still remain. All they can do in the present stage of human evolution is to create an international institution which shall act as an international policeman. Just as the creation of city police forces has not stopped all crime but has nevertheless prevented much crime, so the creation of such an institution could not stop all wars but may prevent many wars. Every such proposal has its own special accompanying dangers. Yet, some proposal must be accepted and realized, whatever its dangers, because in no other way can the prospect of a more peaceful life open up more quickly for humanity. If coming history should show a tragic failure to realize the contemporary proposal, that would be only because the deeper lessons of vanishing history, echoed here, have been insufficiently learned or wholly ignored. But just as the grim necessities of war forced overdue changes on us only when they were no longer avoidable, so the grim necessities of peace will force upon us those personal and national changes which many are still too unevolved to make on their own. A new and better world will come in the end and after all. But to the extent that we let it come out of compulsion, not out of volition, we have to suffer greatly during its labor pains. In the end the word will replace the sword. It is questionable whether absolute harmony will ever prevail amongst men, unless and until they first fulfill the spiritual goal which God ever holds before them. Social life creates its own problems, its own conflicts of group and personal interests. National life leads to angry quarrels with other nations or aggressive invasions of them. In the world of manifested forms, each of which is different from all others in some points, there will necessarily be friction at those points at some times. A kingdom of perfect harmony on earth is apparently not possible. The world's nature and human nature seem to forbid it. But what we cannot find outside ourselves, does exist and may be found deep within ourselves. When Jesus once announced the good news to his hearers and told them in plain words that the kingdom of heaven was within them, he meant, if he meant anything at all, that the most important and most desirable thing in life was not to be found in any external place, thing, person, or position. It was to be found only in the hidden strata of the thought and feeling of man. The bellowing doctrinaire, who thinks otherwise, who persuades people to see only the surface of their problems, may say what he likes, but a physical utopia has never existed and may never be found. It is like a mirage which draws men on only to delude them. It is either a never receding horizon or else a dream from which its deluded seekers must wake up. The dream's creator may paint pleasant pictures of an ideal society or even religious ascetic community where all will be well and everyone will be happy, but the reality will never be like that, for it would still have to be built with the material of fallible and imperfect men. If the ashrams, spiritual retreats of the Orient, and religious monasteries of the Occident, with so lofty and unworldly a doctrine as many of them possess, have been unable to develop perfectly harmonious and morally untainted communities among themselves, but on the contrary suffer from the petty weaknesses of pitiful human nature, what help is there for realizing this dream outside their walls, where aspiration is less urgent and less deep? Where is the human material for such a superhuman society? Can it be found sufficiently anywhere today? Earthly millenniums are always postponed, never realized. So it has been in the past, so it shall be in the future. Any idealistic society or colony can be only relatively good at best, good only at and for a certain time and a certain place. It can never escape from the relativity, imperfection, and transiency which permeate this world. Human nature would cease to be its present ignorant self if it were to perform the vicarious sacrifices which the social or humanitarian or religious idealists' rosy but fallacious optimism expect of it. The paradise men want to attain is a condition they must inwardly create by slow degrees for themselves. As soon as men make themselves spiritually worthy of a finer world, they will have some approach toward it. A wiser practicality would not seek to establish a kingdom of heaven on earth, in the sense of a physical utopia, for its own sake. It would be too strongly imbued with the realization of transiency in all things and too profoundly perceptive of the inherent imperfection in all things to be deceived by such a materialist aim. Rather would it seek to establish a better earthly home for mankind for the sake of using it as a springboard whence to aspire for the true kingdom of heaven, which is and always will be an inner one. It is not a spatial one. Jesus, the skillful angler of men, warned against looking for it, lo here, or lo there. For, behold, the kingdom of God is within you. Yet not a few of his followers have fallen into the belief that this kingdom can be externalized. They believe that some kind of sacerdotally controlled utopia can be created, just as a section of the materialists believe that only a sacerdotally free economic utopia can be created. The mystical dreamers believe that some kind of perfectionist community can be created. But a collection of imperfect human beings can never lead to such a result. The truth here is that the external problems which torment man are really projections of the internal problems which he has failed to solve right within his heart and mind. There is no adequate answer to the principal questions of politics and economics without first finding an adequate answer to the larger questions of life itself, which necessarily include the questions: what is man? What are the real objects for which an organized society exists? What are the final ends to be worked out through its means? Unless we lay hold of their correct answers, we shall only be working in the dark and wasting energies quite uselessly, or worse, gravely harm the human stuff out of which society is made. Ignorance of these answers is the primary cause of our present sad lot. The distress of today grips us like a horrible quagmire into which we sink deeper with every step forward, simply because we do not know and cannot see the proper destination toward which we ought to move. On the other hand, if we secure a clear conception of these objects and ends, we shall be able to work more efficiently, act more effectively and live more happily. But how can we do so successfully unless we know the larger direction which the evolutionary forces of life itself are inexorably compelling it to take? Without a knowledge of the divine will, we may only stumble in the dark and perhaps hurt ourselves grievously, as we have already hurt ourselves during this tragic century. Hitherto, we have fulfilled our destiny blindly and unconsciously, which means painfully and stupidly. But the policy of spiritual drift will no longer pay. We might get away with it in easy times, but we cannot get away with it in these sternly critical times. The problems which press down on humanity may be mostly political and economic and therefore should be dealt with by economic and political measures. But their background remains moral and metaphysical. No solution can be a fundamental one which ignores these two elements. No way in which humanity can save itself from the danger which confronts it will prove satisfactory if it leaves out the spiritual way. Every other way, if taken alone, will yield only failure as its result in the end. Only when the politician and the economist, the statesman and the soldier will have the sense to perceive this and the courage to admit it, only when they will have the humility to declare themselves semi-bankrupt and with insufficient assets can the miracle happen and the aid of a higher power come to our rescue and do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. What is best for the individual is in the long run also best for society. Whoever surveys the unrolled picture of his own existence or that of human existence as a whole and without prejudice will find this truth irrefutable. And if the individual can attain true happiness only by following a better way of living, society also can attain it only likewise. If easier ways are followed, then lesser results must be expected. From this standpoint, political, economic, and social reforms cannot by themselves lead to the true happiness of man. This is not to say that they are not needed, for they may lead to his partial or transient happiness. They are useful palliatives which may relieve his pain, not radical remedies which can cure his sickness. An industrial economy which does not in practice recognize man as a spiritual being or the universe as outworking divine laws, breeds psychic perils for its people. Even if its planners provide a more satisfactory place in which the general mass of people can live, they cannot provide the ideals for which those people will have to live if they are to fulfill their incarnation's higher purpose, ideals which will in the end determine the fate of that place. Man proposes, God disposes, may sound trite but is still quite operative. Those realists and rationalists who would dismiss the application of worthy ideals as being nothing more than dreamers' catchwords and impracticable slogans, delude themselves. Our failure to build a worthwhile society is primarily a moral failure. But before there can be moral reform, there must be spiritual reform. This is the root of all the others. We ought not in our judgment of materialistic doctrine preaching otherwise and the misguided men who symbolize it in the world today, misjudge the masses who have been befogged into it. We must not forget their ultimate equality, which links them with God. We must remember that in their blind, unconscious way they, too, are seeking the truth. They, too, will one day stand hushed in the presence of the Spirit. They, too, will eventually accept the saving ideal of goodwill as against the destructive ideal of hate. They, too, will learn to know that the divine love is back of all events and that so soon as men turn to look for it, they will find it moving toward them. Our Father is still in heaven and our job is to recognize our sonship. This single truth is at the core of all spiritual teaching. Chapter 3. The Machine Age. Today's worship of speed in living, doing, and making has produced nervous tensions which in turn have driven men to seek relief through artificial stimulants and narcotic drugs. The weaker-willed ones among them have done so to excess and maimed themselves in moral character in the end. A different consequence of this worship seems trivial but is actually not at all what it seems. There has developed a contempt for lands where the tempo of change is slower, where the passage from an old-time way to a mechanized existence lags markedly. Behind this contempt lies a failure to understand why the people in those lands want to be left alone and undisturbed, why they prefer to work out their development at their own pace and not lose whatever inner contentment they possess. The two nations on this planet who have made speed a high ideal of living have thereby become incapable of sympathizing with the wishes of backward peoples who prefer to preserve and continue their dilatory rhythm of living. The latter are satisfied to take only a little part in the race for power and possessions. They regard the environment of the Western nations as unattractive. the mental condition as a kind of madness, and the rush and turmoil is not worth the price involved. More curiously, they consider the machine as a kind of toy. Nevertheless, despite their views, it is true that modern industrial methods, because of their tremendous productive capacity, gained by mass techniques based on machines, have come to stay. But have they come to stay in their present shape? They give the worker his bread and butter, but they also deprive him of inner satisfactions and individual functional value. They turn him to some extent into a machine part and bereave him of his manhood. Insofar as the machine robs him of his individuality and makes him perform the same few mechanical movements every day throughout his working life, it is liable to stunt him. The assembly lines in huge factories which pour out masses of goods do not make any demands on the creative skills of the workers, but merely keep them engaged on repetition jobs. The physical arrangements and mental atmosphere of such factories are often harmful to the human nervous system. We must have mechanized industry, but we need not have it at such a heavy price. Those among the industrialists and economists who treat man, including themselves, only as a statistical cipher, or as a mere factory hand to be mass-regimented as a mere instrument of production like the lathe, and not also as a sensitive, feeling and thinking human being, atrophy his talents and spoil his feeling for creativity. They deal with human robots and are unconcerned with higher values. In their worship of the mechanized view of life, they lose their balance just as those other worshippers of the machine who denounce them politically in the name of enforced collectivism also lose their balance. Both are hypnotized by the modern form of materialism. Both believe the machine will so lighten labor and increase prosperity that everyone will henceforth be happy. Inventive technology can do and is doing wonderful things in this epoch, but it can never make anyone really happy. It has despoiled man of drudgery, but can it, for instance, despoil him of mental distress? How many of the millions of factory workers have developed mentally beyond the machines they tend? And how many celebrated executives of the business world have become anything more than mere automatons of the business world? The panorama of our great cities presents a spectacle, for it is to these fast-growing many-people dwelling places of the Western world that the pioneers of today have been drawn. Great builders, great engineers, astute financiers, clever scientists, enterprising merchants, the millions who toil at their bidding, together with artists, writers and other men of dreams, are all there. In the cities, forces of every kind fight for predominance, ambitions high and low strive for prizes in tempting dress. The field of business becomes at times almost a battlefield. Giants of intellect and cunning wage war therein. Like a huge mill, each town grinds out of its inhabitants what they possess of ability, energy and courage. City life develops human mentality. Its competition sharpens human faculty. This is good when balanced by the finer feelings, but bad when not. Life in the larger towns simulates intelligence, fosters ambition and develops personality, whereas life on the farms toughens the body, increases self-reliance but flattens personality. The men and women who live in overgrown cities have largely lost that direct contact with nature which their farming forebears possessed. The values and virtues which city life develops in mankind turn into demerits and vices when it is carried to excess. When a metropolitan area is not restricted at a certain point, it creates trouble, danger and evil. It becomes a contributory cause to the soulless materialism of its inhabitants. The size of this mammoth human hive, which is a modern metropolis, is now idiotically inconvenient. The very difficulties of internal transport must in time force a reduction or rearrangement. The quick growth of huge commercial and industrial centers has led to artificial, unnatural living. This has produced unbalance in mind and unhealth in body. The life of a family which knows only hard stone pavements, confining brick walls and low plaster ceilings, which regards trees, grass and flowers with awed amazement as unfamiliar things, which is incessantly subjected to the nerve-pounding noises of urban existence, is a life in some danger of spiritual hurt. Those who live in ugly alleys or in the rabbit warren of tight-packed, Treeless streets do not see the same bright mental horizons as those who live in leafy avenues. With the widespread use of motor vehicles and the consequent conversion of streets into nerve-wracking centers of noise and hurry and incessant activity, each giant city becomes mentally poisonous to the human race, breeding psychological tensions and spiritual dissociations. The strident noises harm the nerves and disrupt mental health. A society which accepts them so unhesitatingly must tend to become a more materialistic one. It seems that nothing less than business depression, economic disaster, or even the threat of atomic bombing brings back out of the cities a people who have strayed too far into urban materialism, who have lost their touch with nature and their intuition of spirit. These large cities are our karma that express what we are. As we ourselves improve, we improve them. In these environments into which we incarnate, we find the lessons that we have to learn, or we get the fruits of what we have done in the past, or we find conditions which provoke us to change and improve them, and in so doing we develop ourselves. The current belief that the existing industrial economy is the most efficient one possible, may be correct from a technical point of view, but too often ignores its destructive effects on the human nervous organism, creative talents and moral character. A proper appraisal of its efficiency would take them into reckoning. To the degree that the actual appraisal disregards them, it does so because its fundamental view of man is one-sided and materialistic. Today, when science has made life complicated and intellect has made man restless, a poised, serene attitude seems beyond the horizon. Yet its need is an imperative one. Only a philosophical mysticism can show how a man caught up amid the complex maze of urban activities and struggling against the speed and pressure of city life, jarred by its raucous and flurried note, and perhaps, burdened also by the struggle for economic necessities, may abolish his inner conflict and keep his mind in a sublime calm. But the multitudes are unready inwardly for such a philosophical approach. So whatever can be done by outward means to keep their psyche better balanced, should be done. The craving for the countryside's green beauty and healing peace which expresses itself in weekend runs out of town, or in little gardens surrounding a house, is at bottom a spiritual one. The severance from all contact with nature for long periods starves the city dweller of vital nourishment for his inner being. Sadhu Sundar Singh, the Indian Christian mystic, once said that he always felt the spirit of evil to be powerful in large towns. To go into big towns is always against my desire, and I have to constrain myself to do so. I know why hermits prefer to live in caves and mountains. I much prefer it myself. But I was told once in an ecstasy to help others in this world, he added. He also thought that materialism is more prevalent in towns than villages. When a sensitive man walks in the city streets, after his feelings have been healed by the solitary groves of nature, he feels remote from these houses that so often are not homes but barricades for sorrow. On the other hand, it is rare to meet a farm laborer who has a mind beyond the stolid drudgery of his toil in the fields. The romantic idealization of peasant life breaks down as soon as we think of the illiterate, half-starved peasants of India and China. It is as foolish in this 20th century as the romantic idealization of the townsman's life. The philosophic thinker does not attack the uprise of industrialism, which was inevitable and necessary, yet he defends the contemporary movement towards decentralization, because that is the environmental need today. He notes phenomena which any thoughtful observer can witness are the phenomena of the psychological and physical results of both urban and rural life. He counsels the need of a properly balanced economy, a way of social existence which will be developed all round and not be lopsided or extremist. He may rightly deplore the repulsive evils which excessive one-sided unbalanced industrialism has brought in its wake, but he must justly admit that the standard of physical prosperity and comfort is, in every country, proportionate to the use made of machines. Critics should protest not against machine processes, which indeed are so useful and profitable, but against the way in which a blind industrialism has led the men and women employed to operate them, into unnatural living and loss of higher values, whenever it has failed to differentiate them as spiritually cored human beings from the mere machines themselves. We of today cannot easily return to primitive or medieval conditions. The machine may be used against men and women, as in war, or for them, as in peace. The ascetic notion, popularized by such men as Tolstoy and Gandhi, that it is necessarily harmful and mostly evil, has a basis of partial truth but, taken alone and unbalanced, is unphilosophical. The machine is here and we must accept it. But this is not to say that we must allow it to master us, to enslave us. With a spiritually awakened, artistically creative race, the machine civilization would no longer retard true growth but would be kept in its place and utilized as a useful help to promote this growth and elevate society. Science and invention, organization and technique will open up great possibilities for the future physical comfort of mankind. The advance of invention saves the human race from monotonous and repetitive jobs and thus liberates the human mind for higher ones. If men choose to use this liberation for degrading purposes, that is the risk accompanying every racial advance. But if the risk becomes too great, if human life is harnessed solely to materialistic aims, then inventions only hinder and do not help its true progress. Until the world puts its mechanical inventions, as well as its reforms, on a philosophical basis, as it will eventually have to do, every new good gained carries a new evil with it. Speed is a help to the quicker tempo of modern civilization, but we need not therefore speed away with that which is needed to cultivate our deepest nature, the true soul. A civilization whose merely mechanical and external efficiency still leaves man an insensitive and soulless creature, is in the end a half failure. All this does not mean, however, that practical attempts to create increasingly better environments should not be made. The improvement of external environments is all to the good. It may of itself help to create an atmosphere in which higher ideals can be more welcome, but in the end it is no substitute for, and can never displace, the improvement of the human entity which has to dwell in that environment. Yet to offer, as mystical but unphilosophic idealists so often offer, the panacea for humanity's social troubles as being solely an individual change of heart, to do nothing more than sit down and wait for this remote change to happen and to dismiss all practical proposals, is to confess intellectual bankruptcy. It is mere lack of balance and obvious narrowness of perspective which make these idealists assert that a change in human nature is the only reform required. Their mistake is not in asserting that a change of heart will yield a change of environment. This is quite true. It is in rejecting the second whilst waiting for the first. For there are bad things in human environment which either prevent such a change happening or, if they cannot prevent it, hinder it from sustaining itself. This historic panorama, which is a tragic reality to the millions who suffer in it but a mere shadow dance to the mystics who meditate apart from it, is correctly evaluated by the philosopher alone. Philosophy, because its ideal reasonably balances self-centeredness and altruism, definitely requires outer change to be made but at the same time still holds that man's largest hope lies in so improving the individual character that the improvement inevitably affects all social relations with other men and spreads from within outward. It insists that although the forces which shape the external fate of men and nations are much more internal, psychological, ethical and mental, nevertheless effectual contributions also come from the external, social, political and economic ones. It agrees that the way of moral and mental evolution provides the real basis for worthwhile change but it also asserts that such evolution can be helped and quickened by providing better physical conditions. It deplores the sad situation which shows our best thinkers beginning to forsake 19th century scientific materialism and rediscover 20th century spiritual truth, while the toiling masses ignorantly lag some distance behind them. Nowadays the way to the spiritual domain lies to some extent through the social one. The environmental ills must be ameliorated to some extent before people, the rich as well as the poor, can become aware of their inner ills and thence bestow their attention on a higher good. The man who is driven to an enforced and continuous preoccupation with the problem of earning a livelihood or supporting his family, would be foolish indeed if he did not give this problem the front rank importance which is its reasonable due. Even the man who is more fortunate, is doing nothing wrong but everything right in providing himself with material comforts and modern conveniences, with a good home, decent clothes and adequate food.